Welcome to this special highlights program of a satellite symposium at the 13th World Conference on Lung Cancer of the International Association of the Study of Lung Cancer, or ISLAC. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. We gathered five clinical investigators, Drs. Tom Lynch, Vince Miller, Tony Mock, Joan Schiller, and Jean-Charles Soria, to discuss the clinical application of tissue biomarkers in the management of lung cancer. And to begin, Dr. Lynch reviewed some of the key recent findings in predicting response and resistance to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
From 2004 to 2006, it became pretty clear to us that erlotinib prolonged survival when given a second or third line therapy compared to placebo. We knew that erlotinib and gefitinib can cause dramatic responses in a subset of patients, and that mutations best predict this group. And we also learned that combination with chemotherapy back in 2004, 2006 didn't likely provide a great benefit. Now, it was the identification of the epidermal growth factor receptor mutations that ushered in an era of molecular medicine in lung cancer. When we look at mutations, there are generally two important groups of mutations. These mutations occur in the tyrosine kinase domain. They tend to be either exon 19 deletions or exon 21 point mutations. There are some mutations we find in exon 18, and there are some resistance mutations that we find in exon 20. But that gives you the range of where the mutations are. And from 2004 to 2006, we've actually been able to understand what most of these are, which is simplified testing and evaluation for these. Now, when one prospectively treats a patient who has a mutation, you can see a dramatic response. So, Leisha's study screened 98 patients, 35 had EGFR mutations, 55% response rate to gefitinib, 11-month PFS, 21-month OS. And if you see the waterfall plot, the vast majority of patients had very nice shrinkage in their tumors. So what we learned from not only Leisha's study, but studies which were done in Korea, Japan, and in Spain, is that when you prospectively treat mutation-positive patients, you cause responses in the range of about 70%. Response rate is about 70%. About 30% of mutation patients don't respond to treatment with EGFR TKI. I would argue that's one of the most important groups to look at and try to figure out why that inherent resistance emerges. But we also know that resistance is important as an acquired phenomenon. Because unlike CML, where a patient who's in a molecular CR early on with CML can have a very prolonged, almost normal lifespan from treatment with a drug like Gleevec, we know that when you treat EGFR mutations with TKIs, resistance emerges relatively quickly. When one looks at resistance, you see that EGFR gets phosphorylated. The enzyme is phosphorylated. It then binds to ERBB3, among other partners that are preferred binding partners for EGFR, and it sets off a signaling cascade within the cell that causes the cell to proliferate and give it a proliferative advantage. What you can see is that when you use gefitinib or erlotinib, you inhibit the phosphorylation of the tyrosine kinase, and what you do is you then inhibit signaling, and that's how we hope these drugs work. Now, what are some of the ways that the cell can become resistant? T790M is a mutation which occurs in the active tyrosine kinase area, and that essentially prevents gefitinib or erlotinib from being able to inhibit the enzyme, and therefore normal signaling occurs. And this is not terribly different from the story in chronic myelogenous leukemia with secondary resistance. The second mechanism of resistance with MET amplification, basically the cell, even with gefitinib or erlotinib on board, finds an alternative way to signal through AKT and through PI3 kinase. And so MET amplification becomes the alternative mechanism for signaling the cell to grow and proliferate. There's also a purported fourth way, which is IGFR activation. And you can activate the insulin-like growth factor receptor, and that becomes yet an alternative way of becoming resistant to EGFR tyrosine kinase activity. Now, one question I get asked a lot from a clinical standpoint is, what is the role of RAS mutations? And what you see is there's very little overlap. In fact, there's no overlap between KRAS mutations and EGFR activity mutations. In my practice, I've seen probably one or two patients that I can recall that have had both KRAS and EGFR activating mutations. They're remarkably unusual to see them together. So where are we now in 2006 to 2008? In terms of resistance mechanisms, T790M, probably about 50%. Some people have argued it's as high as 80% of resistance. CMET amplification, IGF signaling. Some people have argued that the non-kinase role of EGFR is important, and I still think there's a large group that would still go under the category of unknown. How do we overcome this resistance? There are dual kinase inhibitors that inhibit T790M, possibly irreversible inhibitors, CMET, IGF. These are all targets that people are looking at in this area. So I would argue that EGFR mutation testing in 2009 is ready for prime time. The test can be done reliably on 10 unstained slides from a core biopsy. Almost always, you can get an EGFR mutation test from a larger resection specimen. And occasionally, as the technology gets better, we're getting to the point where doing this on a fine needle aspirate is certainly possible. 2 to 3 week testing interval remains a challenge, but we now know that the actual time to do the test can be brought down to just a day. And most of our time is just gathering the specimens and bringing them in for testing itself. Rebiopsy of patients, I think, is also a very important trend that we need to look at. Vince Miller presented some terrific data at this meeting and at ASCO, which looked at the Memorial experience of rebiopsying patients who became resistant so we can figure out why those patients have abnormalities. And then finally, I think the generation of circulating tumor cells and analysis of circulating tumor cells will provide yet another way to look for evidence of resistance. EGFR provides a model for the paradigm of oncogene addiction. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors, whether they're done in Boston or Beijing, shrink a tumor in 70% of patients with EGFR mutations and should be considered as a care standard for patients who harbor these activating mutations. Never in light smokers with adenocarcinoma should be tested as early in the course of therapy as possible, but I think it's very important to know that mutations do still occur in smokers. And using a rationale for how to have a reasonable testing strategy for smokers is also important. And then rebiopsy of responders at the time of progression can definitely help guide future therapy.
Thanks, Tom. One of the themes today is going to be which, if any, of these assays should be a routine part of clinical practice. I mean, obviously, a doc in practice is about to see a breast cancer patient. First question is going to be, what's the HER2 ER and maybe RT-PCR in terms of oncotype? Should EGFR mutation testing be looked at the same way, and in which patients? Tony, what do we know about the so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs and whether or not maybe they're going to be able to overcome this resistance?
Well, I mean, there are two being investigated intensively. Both have been able to form the covalent bond with the ATP. So as a result, that this mechanism may not be active in such a regard. So it helped, in a sense, is that once you had the covalent bonded to the situation, that the change of the T790M may not be able to have the affinity for the ATP.
Jean-Charles, what do we know about the mechanism of action of the EGFR TKIs and the wild type versus mutants? There's been speculation, maybe, I'm curious, Tom, what you think about this too, in terms of whether in the wild type it's an effect on apoptosis as opposed to proliferation. What do we know about that right now?
I would say that in the mutant, you have a likelihood of having massive shrinkage, objective response that argue for an immediate apoptotic effect. And in some of the wild type, you just have stable disease that argues for more of a cytostatic effect. And going back to the mechanism of resistance, I would argue that there is not only the irreversible PONER inhibitors, there are some non-irreversible PONER inhibitors like BMS-514 that have shown activity in some of these patients.
Interesting. Tom, what's your take on the issue of wild versus mutant type, and how much benefit do we actually see in the wild-type patients?
So I think TKIs do have benefit in wild-type patients. I've always felt there is some benefit, but you don't see the same concept of oncogenic addiction or the other concept of oncogenic shock. And when you treat with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor to an oncogene-addicted drug, you get this phenomenon of oncogenic shock where the major proliferative thrust of the tumor is shut down and apoptosis is massive and immediate. I think with tyrosine kinase inhibitors in wild-type patients, you clearly have a cytostatic or cytotoxic effect. It's just much more modest in terms of its degree.
Quick question to Joan. What are your thoughts about EGFR mutation testing in clinical practice? It's certainly, yeah, patients are getting resection. They have tons of tumor there. And people say, well, we'll just wait and see if they develop a relapse and we'll think about testing or maybe just try out a TKI empirically. Again, breast cancer, colon cancer with KRAS, we're taking a different approach.
So I probably am the minority on the panel here in this regard, but in terms of evidence-based medicine, at this point in time, I don't think we have level one evidence to suggest that testing for mutation positive impacts survival. Certainly PFS, certainly response rates, but not quite survival. And I think Tony's going to show his data coming up very shortly.
One of the most discussed clinical trials in lung cancer over the past year is the so-called IPASS study that compared gefitinib to carboplatin paclitaxel as first-line therapy of patients with adenocarcinoma and a non-smoking or minimally smoking history. The principal investigator, Dr. Mock, commented on the overall results and results based on EGFR mutation status.
Clearly, there are two populations of patients here, mutation positive and mutation negative. And then we were able to obtain sufficient sample, which is, I think, the essential part of this clinical trial. And if we have 261 being positive for mutation, and the rate is 60%, which is exactly what we want it to be, about between 50 to 60%. And furthermore, based on this, we're able to demonstrate a high response rate of 70% in mutation-positive patients and only 1.1% in the mutation-negative patient. The hazard ratio of mutation-positive 0.48 compared to being negative, it is actually hazardous to receive gefitinib in the first-line situation. So, at this point, now that we have learned the importance of mutation, I think the future study primarily should be driven by the patient with the mutation.
So, Tom, let's get back to this practical issue. What are the patients, for example, non-smoker or patient with adenocarcinoma, that you think right now should have mutation testing in clinical practice outside of protocol?
I think outside protocol, adenocarcinoma in a light or never smoker would be the person I think definitely should get tested outside of it. I think it's harder to know groups beyond that. But I think for now, where you think there's a significant risk of having a mutation, I think that a light or never smoking adenocarcinoma patient would be someone who I would feel is important to test outside of a clinical trial. Part of clinical trials, I think you can broaden that, but outside of a clinical trial, I'd limit it to that.
John Farrells?
I will argue that the European situation is a little different since we have an EMEA approval of gefitinib any line based on mutation. I would argue that with the evolution of the technology and notably antibodies generated for EGFR mutation, you will ask it for everyone.
What about quality control, Tony, in terms of EGFR mutation? In ER, HER2, and breast cancer, it's been a lot of questions about how accurate these tests are, you know, tremendous clinical implications. What about EGFR mutation testing?
Well, I think right now there's two major groups. One is using the so-called sequencing technique within PCR. And the benefit of it is really highly specific and is still so-called a golden standard decided by Tom originally. However, you need a sufficient number of cancer cells with the mutation, approximately 10%. The other group of technique is using the ARMS technique. The kit is available. It's called DXX. And then the good part about this test is that it tests for 29 mutations simultaneously, and it's quite convenient. Its sensitivity is very high, meaning that it's probably 1% of the cell being positive that you'll be able to detect it. In the IPASS study, we decided to use DXS.
So Vince, what about FISH and IHC? That's been confusing to me for the last couple of years, but when I saw those IPASS slides, it started to come together. Is there any role right now, do you think, or do you think there's going to be a role for FISH or IHC?
I personally don't see a role for them presently, and I think we've addressed the question fairly rigorously regarding EGFR FISH. There may be a role for FISH with other genes which can be amplified and relevant to lung cancer behavior. I think Tony's curve, when you look at EGFR mutated and non-mutated patients and see how those groups who have high copy number differ so greatly, is really the best explanation.
So, Tom, I assume from what you're saying that, again, we're talking about outside of protocol setting, this is going to change what you do. Does that mean that you're going to be thinking about erlotinib or an EGFR TKI upfront as opposed to chemo or chemobiologic?
I've actually been doing this for a couple of years, so it won't completely change what I do. But I think Tony's data should make people feel comfortable using first-line EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, be it erlotinib or be it gefitinib if you're in a country where gefitinib is approved. I think one of the key questions, and I'm curious what Joan thinks of this, in patients where you can't test for whatever reason, there's no tissue available, not possible to test, in that setting, I tend to still use chemotherapy. One of the things I learned from Tony's study is that if you don't have the mutation information,
even if you have a woman from Tokyo who's a never smoker, I now use chemotherapy in that setting. Joan, what do you do about that?
I think it would depend upon your level of clinical suspicion. I mean, if you did have a never smoking woman from Tokyo, chances are probably good, but that they in fact do have a mutation, even though you might not be able to prove it. So that is a patient that I would actually go with an EGF TKI first.
Tony?
Yes, I would like to add a comment to that. We face that situation a lot in Hong Kong because a lot of diagnoses are made by cytology. So what I usually do is, of course, after discussion with patient, we make the decision, but one of the criteria to look at is how big is the tumor load. If the patient looking at the fact that there is possibility of imminent problem, I probably would prefer chemotherapy. But if it's multiple small nodules, the patient not short of breath, we can have months or a few weeks to wait and see. I may lean a little bit towards the use of TKI. So the clinical situation may also change my decision.
Vince, what about the issue of combining an EGFR antibody, cetuximab, and an EGFR TKI?
Well, I think that's an experimental approach currently. We did show an abstract here on behalf of our group where we've looked at that combination and acquired resistance. There are some theoretical reasons why it might work, but I think outside of a clinical trial setting, there's not a rationale to pursue it in routine practice.
What about the actual issue, Joan, of histologic diagnosis, adeno versus squamous? We sort of took it for granted for a while. Maybe it wasn't that critical. How confident can we be with small tumor specimens that we can even differentiate between adeno and squamous?
Right. Well, I think that's going to become more and more of an issue going forward. It's funny, you know, in the old days, we taught our medical students that if it was a non-small cell lung cancer, it didn't really matter what the histology is. I think that's clearly changing, and we are going to have to work more and more with our pathologists to figure out how to do that.
Tom, what about the non-smoker with squamous cell? Are you going to get EGFR mutation testing?
I probably would, only because I wouldn't believe the histology. A non-smoker with squamous cell is a pretty rare bird, and I probably would test only because it just seems so unusual.
Dr. Miller then commented on his tissue-based algorithm for deciding about systemic therapy.
The identification of EGFR TK domain mutations in lung adenocarcinomas and their profound sensitivity to a drug has really revolutionized how we think about non-small cell lung cancer. It's not the whole story, it is a paradigm. And in parallel, and particularly what Neil just alluded to, the import of distinguishing, say, squamous from non-squamous pathology as a marker of both efficacy, say, in terms of pemetrexed, or safety in terms of bevacizumab, has also served to make non-small cell lung cancer well more than one disease. Oftentimes, the patient comes with stained or unstained slides. And if you talk to someone who's a dedicated thoracic pathologist, that NOS category should be able to be whittled down to about 5 to 10% with appropriate immunohistochemical and morphologic analysis. Although in multiple cooperative group studies, we commonly see a number of 15 to 20%. In the U.S., we see about 60% adenocarcinomas, and about 3 in 10 patients have squamous cell carcinoma. I'm going to focus on my approach to the adenocarcinoma patients, because that is indeed where the vast majority of the EGF receptor mutations are identified. So we ask all our patients to bring 15 unstained slides or a pathology block. Yes, problems happen. They bring one slide. They bring 15 stained slides. They bring the wrong slides. They bring the slides from their colon biopsy 4 years ago. But that being said, we're doing better over time, and I think venues like this can only improve our ability to get at the right information. So if the individual has the unstained slides, we proceed with what we call our reflex testing for EGFR and KRAS mutations. And again, the devil's in the detail sometimes. Our standard testing presently are PCR-based reactions looking for the two most common mutations, EGFR exon 19 del and the 21-point mutation. So we miss some mutations. We miss some sensitizing mutations in 19. We miss some resistance mutations in 20. And as we go to a panel now of the sequenome where we can detect greater breadth of the mutations, we will perhaps detect some of these on a second run. In individuals who have such a mutation, then I consider EGFR TKI therapy initially, or there may be a role for chemotherapy in these patients as suggested by work in the TRIBUTE study in which I participated several years ago. And this is not a standard approach, but it is a consideration in some settings. If the individual has a KRAS mutation, I would proceed with cytotoxic chemotherapy. In individuals without a demonstrable EGFR and KRAS mutation, we now reflexively test for something called ALK-FISH for looking for fusion partners and amplification of the ALK gene. And some of you may have heard the updated presentation from Dr. Kwok and Dr. Shaw on the high efficacy of a kinase inhibitor for this fusion protein in appropriate patients with non-small cell lung cancer. So individuals who are positive for this marker would be referred for a clinical trial, and those negative, we would proceed with the chemotherapy leg of our algorithm. Now the tough situation. What if no slides are available? I'll tell you, if an individual has a low tumor burden, relatively asymptomatic, somebody from the east side who's read about all this stuff, we may well rebiopsy them. If rebiopsy is not considered, tumor burden's too high, needs therapy quickly, individual declines, et cetera, et cetera. Really, the next question then in my mind is, are they bevacizumab eligible? And there are different ways to cut this. I tend to use the more relaxed criteria to determine bevacizumab eligibility, which includes patients with previously treated brain metastases, low molecular weight heparins, and perhaps even extrathoracic or peripheral squamous cell tumors, albeit the latter is quite uncommon. So for the patients who are going to get cytotoxic chemotherapy, in my practice, if they're Bev eligible, they will get Bev, and they will get it with cis or carboplatin, and most commonly, pemetrexed, although certainly other agents could be considered. And similarly, for those who are Bev ineligible, they would get the chemotherapy doublet. Neil asked me to focus on this area of the ALK-FISH testing and the implications of that. ALK fusions in lung cancer, so these are translocations that result in fusion genes, analogous to BCR-ABL. Why they happen and how a particular partner is identified is the subject of a lot of research in a very basic level from multiple labs. But this particular fusion involves the anaplastic lymphoma kinase, or ALK, fused to the echinoderm microtubule-associated protein like 4, or EML4. And this was first described 2 years ago. 2 years ago, that's pretty good. It took us 5 years to sort of get the EGFR story to prime time. And in 2 years, we've gotten enough momentum in the field to now get this marker diagnostic and an agent in trial that's working. There are multiple partners for the ALK protein, and the most common in lung cancer appears to be the EML4, but nearly all the fusion proteins seem to involve the kinase domain, so they should be susceptible to kinase inhibition. Activation enhances proliferation, survival, through some of the players you've seen before, things like PI3 kinase, JAK-STAT, and KRAS and ERK. The frequency in the initial papers was reported to be about 4 or 5% in adenocarcinoma, so one would have to screen in an unselected population a large number of patients to find one patient with this mutation. And if one were doing this in a real-time fashion, rather than testing as individuals walk in the door, it would be hard to complete a clinical trial in a meaningful period of time. We'll probably be having similar discussions to what Tom and others alluded to earlier about why some patients fail to respond to these agents or why they respond transiently. And this just shows how PI3 kinase mediates in part growth signals from the ALK protein. And therefore, you could envision if a patient, say, had a PI3 kinase mutation or some other dysregulation in that axis, they might be insensitive to effective inhibition of the ALK kinase. So these are results of the trial that Eunice Kwok presented at ASCO and that was updated at this meeting by Dr. Shaw of the drug 0234-1066. And yes, this is not an approved drug yet in lung cancer, so this is an unapproved agent. And I should point out that this drug is an inhibitor both of MET and ALK, which is not necessarily characteristic of all agents in that class. It so happens this agent has that particular property. This trial began with unselected accrual of patients with different histologies and diseases and histories, and then based on early response in a patient with an inflammatory myofibroblastic tumor, it was expanded to include a cohort of lung cancer patients with this ALK fusion. And these are the characteristics of those patients, which provide some help and hope that we may be able to enrich our ability to identify these individuals. These patients tend to be former or never smokers, to have adenocarcinoma, and as you interpret the next body of data, many of these patients were heavily pretreated. That summarized the clinical and pathologic characteristics. Unlike EGFR mutations, early data suggest they may not be prognostic. Like EGFR mutations, these appear essentially to be exclusive from KRAS mutations, and there have been one or two cases reported where individuals also have an EGFR mutation. One of the ways we think we can enrich for detecting this abnormality is to test the subgroup of patients who are EGFR and KRAS non-mutated and never smokers. And the incidence there, as you saw at this meeting and as previously reported by Dr. Shaw's group, can be as high as 25% in that population. The overall response rate at the time of the ASCO presentation was 53%, and four patients had progression at first evaluation. And again, important to try to characterize what coexistent genetic events prevent those individuals from responding. So this is a druggable target. A phase 2 trial of the agent, 0234-1066, in patients with lung tumors with EML4-ALK is planned, or possibly a phase 3 trial. We now routinely test for this at Memorial. It's a FISH test. There are some subtleties in the testing and some things to work through because the genes are located very close to one another on chromosome 2. I would just like to conclude by emphasizing that this is now not one disease. It's probably moved on to 4 or 5 disease, and it may well be like lymphoma or perhaps broader than that in the coming decades. I believe that non-small cell lung cancer, and particularly the adenocarcinomas, must be subtype both pathologically and genotypically. And EGFR mutations are not the end of the story, they're the beginning of the story. They're a watershed event that led to a fundamental paradigm change. I think other druggable kinase mutations will continue to be identified, but again, that in turn is not the final solution to our problems, as an identifiable kinase mutation is probably present in only about a third of advanced non-small cell lung cancer.
Tom, I love those waterfall plots where everybody goes down. When I saw that, I was thinking back to the one that Keith Flaherty showed in melanoma, looking at the BRAF inhibitor. In melanoma, you never think about it, and same kind of thing. What's your take right now on what the frequency is of EGFR mutations, ALK fusion mutations, and just oncogene-addicted tumors in lung cancer, and how much, from a public health point of view, how much of the lung cancer problem you think we could potentially solve using this strategy?
I think it's tough because I think, as Vince pointed out, you're looking at, in North America, 10% are going to have EGFR mutations, probably 4% will have ALK, EML4 ALK. I think it's likely we find a couple more, but I think Vince was correct when he said it's probably going to be about a third, probably not more than a third. I think one of the key things about the ALK story, the patient that Vince showed actually was a patient of mine, and when I treated this woman, it was just like the EGFR mutation. She emailed me on day 2 and said, "I'm all better."
What was her situation when she started treatment?
She was multiply pretreated. I treated her with Tarceva. She had chemotherapy, had Avastin-based therapy, and was progressing, was short of breath, young woman in her late 40s.
Where was her metastatic disease?
She had extensive disease in her lungs, primarily lungs.
And what kind of symptomatology did she have?
Short of breath, was a hiker, was a New Hampshire person, liked to go out, walk around, was an artist professionally, and really had trouble even doing art without being short of breath. And it was within 2 days of starting this drug, she was breathing normally again. And this is exactly what we saw with the EGFR story when that happened.
And what's her situation right now? How long is
it? So she's now been 42 weeks.
Wow.
So it was last August. It's actually 48 weeks. It was last August she started.
Any side effects or toxicity from treatment?
She's done very, very well. Some patients with this drug have had some liver issues, some elevation of LFTs. She hasn't, but it is a drug that you have to watch LFTs carefully.
So, Joan, we try not to get too excited, but you hear a story like that. You don't have to hear too many of them to start thinking, if I were in that situation, maybe I'd want to get on that trial or get tested. Right now, should docs in practice be thinking about figuring out a way to, where can they get the ALK fusion test done, incidentally? Who does it right now? Are you doing it?
It's still done principally at academic labs. Memorial does them, Mass General does it. It's still done principally at a few labs that have the FISH technique worked up. I'm pretty sure that commercial labs are beginning to amp up to do it, though.
And again, mainly non-smokers adenocarcinoma?
Non-smokers. Alice Shaw has a very nice paper that's in press right now that describes the group of people, about 150 people at MGH, tend to be never smokers, tend to be more male, and tend to be younger, as was pointed out by Vince.
And that was the data she presented at ASCO.
Yeah.
So, Joan, is this, you know, like ready for docs in practice to start thinking about?
It's certainly very exciting. I think we need a clinical trial to show us the results.
But there is, as a matter of fact, a phase 3 trial that is going to start,
right,
allowing
exactly.
worldwide recruitment, extremely right. intelligently designed, where there's going to be randomizations against chemotherapy. But those who were on the chemotherapy arm and who progress will be able to get to the compound. Yep. Since this ASCO data, I have had at least 10 patients emailing me in France asking about, I'm a male, never smoker, can I get the drug? So I think the momentum is there, and the momentum is also there to get the tissue and teach the people about the value of the tissue.
There are times when getting on a clinical trial is your only option for something that maybe theoretically could benefit you. Vince, extrathoracic squamous cell in deciding whether or not to use Bev. I thought that was interesting. So you're talking about somebody who has no tumor in their chest but has metastatic disease?
Yeah, individuals who maybe had a lung cancer resected that was squamous cell 2 or 3 years ago or a year ago recur in their bone or their liver or some other site. I think it's been felt to be acceptable to treat those individuals
right.
with bevacizumab.
Or patients with small peripheral squamous cells who are in the same situation.
So in terms of efficacy, Tony, in terms of Bev chemo, that's not the issue. It's just the issue about bleeding.
Well, the original idea of squamous cell excluded is based on David Johnson's phase 2 study of 6 patients with hemoptysis. And so it is exclusion by toxicity, not lack of efficacy. Never been any evidence so there's a lack of efficacy in squamous cell carcinoma.
Jean-Charles, another part of the algorithm I'm curious about was just the use of chemo bevacizumab in patients who were Bev eligible. There are people who bring up the issue, and some of them were involved with some of the research in the FLEX study, for example, who say, well, maybe you ought to consider chemo cetuximab for patients who are Bev eligible. What do you think about that?
Well, the situation is extremely clear at this moment. Only bevacizumab is approved in Europe by EMEA and by FDA in North America. And I think it's a reasonable option in BEV-eligible patients. Obviously, FLEX data shows an overall survival benefit in all histologies, and we are waiting for the appeal on the basis of the rejection of the filing for cetuximab.
What about this issue, Tom? Obviously, we're talking about indirect comparisons. We're talking about weighing risks, different kinds of risks. What about the choice of therapy in the BEV-eligible patient between cetuximab and Bev?
I think in the BEV-eligible patient, I'm still going to use Bev until I have more evidence. I think cetuximab's a drug waiting desperately for a biomarker to show who to use it in or for a way to select which patients get the benefit. I think cetuximab is a drug that works. I think it works with chemotherapy. I think we just have to find out which patients benefit, and we don't know that yet.
Vince?
Certainly in a squamous patient, I feel they're like the poor kids on the block. I do quite regularly consider cetuximab use as a component of initial therapy.
What have you seen in terms of side effects and toxicity, Vince?
Well, in the Northeast, we have a relatively low incidence of anaphylactic type reactions. I found it to be nothing unexpected, and I've seen some responses that I believe are beyond what one would expect with chemotherapy by itself.
And I would just like to respond to about squamous cell carcinoma, that if there is a trial on IGF-1 inhibitor, that would be my preference, because with the preliminary data, that's very exciting. And so if there's a phase 3 study that's ongoing in multiple institutes, that would be my preference.
Could you elaborate a little bit? We're hearing about that in colon cancer and breast cancer, the whole thing with insulin and cancer progression, Tony. Can you kind of provide a brief update about
well,
that?
Well, I mean, the IGF-1 receptor have been actually highly expressed in the squamous cell carcinoma, demonstrated in multiple studies, including MD Anderson group. And then the phase 2 data, there was a recent report in 2008-2009, so the response rate approximately 70% in a squamous cell carcinoma. So now there's 3 studies ongoing. One of the 3 studies is the combination of the IGF-1 inhibitor with chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone in squamous cell carcinoma.
Any tissue biomarkers that predict?
Well, actually, they select the patient by histology, but they definitely will do the translational biomarker.
I want to get back to, again, this issue of selection of biologic in the BEV-eligible patient, Vince. It seems from what we can tell in terms of patterns of care that certainly in the United States, that's the most common choice. How do you look at the risks and benefits of chemo-BEV versus chemo-cetuximab in those patients? Is it efficacy, side effects, or sort of both?
I think that in a patient who's eligible for both, I think probably the number one thing is a little bit more robust survival benefit in a U.S. done trial, whereas the BMS-99 trial that Tom led did not show a statistically significant survival improvement, although the magnitude of survival benefit was similar to that was observed in FLEX. The number of patients studied was smaller. So that's probably the number one driver in my decision making.
One of the most widely utilized biologic agents in oncology and lung cancer is the anti-VEGF antibody bevacizumab, and Dr. Joan Schiller discussed what we currently know about predictors of response to this interesting and valuable agent.
So just kind of bringing back to what clinical data we do know or have proof of in terms of anti-angiogenic agents, this is E4599, which was ECOG's phase 3 randomized trial of carboplatin paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab in patients with non-squamous cell carcinoma of the lung, first-line study. What you can see is there was a improvement in response rate, progression-free survival, and overall survival, suggesting that this pathway is indeed a potentially active target for treatment of cancer patients, including lung cancer patients. So just like with the EGFR pathway, one of the big questions now is what biomarkers, if any, do we have that can help guide us in terms of which patients are most likely to derive benefit from these types of therapies. So, SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, are DNA sequence variation. They're slight variations in the DNA sequence. They can be found in coding or non-coding areas. And it turns out that only about 3 to 5% of a person's DNA actually codes for proteins, so you can get very slight changes. Well, what about VEGF SNPs or VEGF polymorphisms? If there are such things, how would they potentially be able to impact on whether or not an anti-angiogenic agent was likely to be effective? So the theory, at any rate, at this point, is if the VEGF polymorphisms may result in variable binding affinity to the receptor or possibly an altered binding affinity of the targeted agent to the ligand, possibly variations in host response to the anti-angiogenic signals and or potentially different VEGF levels. So that made us wonder, well, what about in our patient population, particularly the 4599 patient population, and whether or not any of these SNPs would predict benefit to bevacizumab? So the study that was reported out of Heinz Lenz's group that was reported at ASCO this year, it is a relatively small study. It was a study looking to identify potential markers that could be proven in a larger study. And basically, they looked at a number of possible SNPs, SNPs that involve molecules in the angiogenesis pathway, the DNA repair pathway, WNK, and looked at a variety of these SNPs and actually found 3 SNPs that did seem to predict for better survival for those patients who got bevacizumab.
Jean-Charles, we've been talking about tissue predictors. We've already, in the past, talked about rash and EGFR inhibitors. Actually, there's an interesting paper out looking at vasomotor symptoms, arthralgias in breast cancer endocrine therapy, correlating symptomatology with fewer recurrences. What do you think about these data looking at hypertension and BEV?
Sure, I think they are quite interesting, and for sure they don't cost a lot. It's just you look at your patients and see what's really going on there. One of the problems of these clinical parameters is that they happen while on therapy. So you don't have them at baseline when you're going to decide whether you want to do this therapy or not. And I think that is the limitation of rash, that is the limitation of hypertension. Maybe they can guide some trial designs where you increase the dose until you get rash or until you get hypertension. But for a baseline decision, they are limited because they are absent at the time you make the decision.
Vince?
I think that's a great distinction. On the other hand, something like a SNP that you could determine prior to treatment might be far more helpful in deciding who might or might not get a given treatment.
In terms of the SNPs, do we know anything more intuitively? In breast cancer is the question. Some of these SNPs are associated with more VEGF production. What do we know about the SNPs here? Were they the same as breast cancer? What do they control?
Some of them were the same. I think the thought is some of them will control VEGF levels themselves, and others will control affinity, either to VEGF binding or to the drug binding to the VEGF.
Tom, any thoughts right now about the mechanism of action of anti-angiogenic agents, particularly BEV? Now, we had our think tank in Miami, and you and Vince were there. We were talking about in the NSABP study where they saw fewer recurrences while the patients were on the BEV, but then by 3 years it came back up. You have Rakesh Jain's normalization hypothesis, your former colleague. Where do you think all this is heading?
I mean, I think as you point out, there's still a great deal of uncertainty regarding what the predominant mechanism of action of BEV is. I suspect it will end up being a combination of properties. I like the Rakesh-Jain model, and that the Rakesh-Jain model explains, I think, some of the reasons that we're seeing this fact that there's a synergy between chemotherapy and antiangiogenic agents such as bevacizumab. When you normalize blood vessels, you possibly may improve delivery of chemotherapy, particularly to hypoxic areas, and Rakesh has very nicely shown that. But I also wonder whether there could be an anti-proliferative effect as well to antiangiogenic agents. I'm not entirely convinced that this is just a blood vessel or vascular phenomena. So I think it's likely that, as of now, I keep an open mind that it's a combination of effects.
Joan, you're one of the leaders of the ECOG adjuvant study looking at the same question as was just reported in colon, which is chemo plus or minus BEV. Any discussions that came out after ASCO, considerations of longer therapy?
Well, we certainly discussed it. Now, our therapy is in fact longer than the colon trial, which was 6 months of maintenance BEV, whereas ours is 12 months of maintenance BEV. It's a different disease. So whether or not that's going to be applicable to lung cancer, I think we're going to have to find out.
You were referring to the issue of gender, and that's been looked at in detail in 4599. Can you comment on what we know about that right now?
In 4599, the results showed that women had a greater response rate if they were on the BEV arm. They had a greater progression-free survival than the control arm. But this unplanned retrospective subset analysis did not show a benefit in overall survival for women. So that's puzzling. So Dr. Heather Wakely in our group went back and looked at gender, and Dr. Julie Brommer looked at a variety of different issues as to why this may or may not be. Really didn't find much in terms of demographic issues or things like that. But what Dr. Wakely looked at was age. And very interestingly, women under the age of 60 did have a strong survival benefit in this retrospective unplanned subset analysis, had a very strong survival benefit, whereas those over the age of 60 did not, suggesting that maybe if you use, say, age as a surrogate for menopausal status, suggesting that there may be some estrogen effects playing in here as well.
Do we know anything about the connection between estrogen and lung cancer?
So, boy, that's a really good question. It turns out that there are actually a lot of studies out there. So it turns out that many lung tumors have ER-beta on it. There now have been two studies, including one published at ASCO this year, which have suggested that if women smokers who are on hormone replacement therapy, if they come down with lung cancer, they tend to do worse than those who are not on hormonal replacement therapy, suggesting that, yeah, there is really an effect on estrogen.
We were talking about the issue of histology, adenocarcinoma, et cetera. I wanted to ask the faculty about a presentation that Alan Sandler, your colleague, in the 4599 study presented at the Chicago meeting, breaking down the impact of adding bevacizumab based on histology. And you see that when you look at the adenocarcinoma patients, which were the majority, you see a much stronger signal than the other subgroups. Vince, we talk about more sophisticated predictors of benefit and trying to estimate when you talk to a patient about what kind of benefit to receive. What are your thoughts about more specifically focusing in on adenocarcinoma?
I would say one of the caveats in this study is that the vast, vast majority of patients had adenocarcinoma. Obviously, they did extremely well by comparative lung cancer standards, but the number of patients who had other types of lung cancer, and it was most commonly non-small cell lung cancer, NOS, did not benefit as greatly. Perhaps the chemotherapy needs to be different in them, because it's been suggested, for example, with pemetrexed that that group does well with in the NSCLC that's not otherwise specified. Biologically, why they would particularly benefit from bevacizumab is not readily apparent to me.
Dr. Saria then commented on tissue predictors of response to chemotherapy in lung cancer.
For cisplatinum, I would say the most robust one with in-depth preclinical and multiple clinical trials, mostly retrospective, but some of them very large, in different solid tumor types, is ERCC1, whether you evaluated it by immunohistochemistry, AQUA, or RT-PCR, as Response Genetics does. But you also have some other players, because in fact, to get rid of the adducts by platinum, you don't only need nucleotide excision repair. You might use mismatch repair. You might use homologous recombination. So there are other factors like BRCA1, MSH2. For gemcitabine, we may have RRM1. For pemetrexed, we are lacking a clear explanation. Maybe thymidine synthase is one of them. And for paclitaxel, as well as for vinorelbine, maybe the MAPTO history that was clearly pointed in breast cancer is of use in lung cancer. And beta-tubulin, we have heard two oral presentations suggesting some interest on beta-tubulin, although it was not a predictive factor, it was more a prognostic factor. Regarding the discrepancies between the primary tumor and the metastasis, there is around one-third discrepancy rate between the primary tumor and the metastasis, either for RAS, EGFR, and ERCC1. And this is different from the story in breast and colorectal, where RAS, for instance, is very much in line. This is not totally true. There are clear data, for instance, on EGFR amplification, showing one more than a third difference between the primary tumor and the metastasis. So let's keep this in mind.
Tom, we actually had a day-long symposium on tissue biomarkers in breast cancer. We had Richard Simon from the NCI there, and he was talking about the strategy that's been used to go back to trials that have already been done. Of course, this was done with Oncotype in breast cancer, with the NSABP trials, retrospectively, prospectively validate biomarkers. For example, maybe to be able to look at SNPs in that kind of a mechanism. Has that kind of research been discussed in lung cancer?
So I think that that's a great point. And one of the differences between breast, colon, and lung is breast and colon, you have such a high percentage of patients who have tissue available to look at. In lung, it's about a third to 40% unless you mandate tissue collection. So I think the lesson from the cetuximab experience is that companies now have an incentive to go ahead and demand prospective collection of tissue so they can go back and ask the kind of questions that they asked with DXS and other types of tissue markers. The reason we can't do that as well in lung is we just don't have the same frequency of sample collection that you have in colon and breast.
Yeah, but Tony, why can't you do that in the adjuvant trials? You got plenty of tissue there, right?
I agree with Tom of what he said, that we demand the tissue, but there's also a problem of the target. In a sense, is that you don't know the target, you don't know the frequency of target, so you never know how big a sample that you may need. Like the ELK, that you probably know is 4%, and you will need a huge number of samples screened before you get a meaningful study going. But when you say that with cetuximab, you don't know exactly what is the target exactly. If you take away the EGFR expression, then how big a sample size you need. Even in adjuvant setting, you may not be able to answer that.
Joan?
I was just going to say, in terms of the problems associated with getting samples with lung cancer, is exactly why we need something like circulating tumor cells.
Yeah.
I mean, that would really, really help that issue.
Actually, I wanted to ask Tom about circulating tumor cells, but also, Tony, I want to ask you about circulating DNA. But first, okay, Jean-Charles, can you kind of put those four things together for us?
Sure, in 2 minutes. Let's say simply that for a normal cell, it is so important to be able to repair DNA, because DNA is the golden part of the cell. That's what tells the cell how to behave, that it cannot rely in a single pathway. So there are at least 6 or 7 parallel DNA repair pathways that go from base excision repair with PARP to nucleotide excision repair with ERCC1, homologous recombinations with BRCA1, and so on and so on. And in fact, these different parallel DNA pathways are usually very well preserved in a normal cell. While in a tumor cell, because deficiency in DNA repair allows for higher genetic instability, that becomes a proliferative advantage that is used by some of the tumor cells that usually have a deficiency of one of these pathways. And that's how we need to take into account this difference to create a good therapeutic index. So, for instance, we heard in last ASCO very nice data on PARP inhibition in triple-negative breast cancer and PARP inhibition in ovarian cancers that were BRCA1 mutated. And the theory is the triple-negative are equivalent of BRCA1 mutated because they have low levels of BRCA1 by a variety of mechanism. Well, it happened to be that in lung cancer, we do also have tumors with lower levels of BRCA1 on PARP. These are adenocarcinomas, have much lower levels than squamous cell carcinomas. And in other pathways, like mismatch repair, we do have, for instance, low MSH2 that we reported at ASCO. And probably the synthetic lethality concept,
I knew you were going to say that.
Which is not a bad word. I mean, synthetic lethality is
thinking about the blockade of two major parallel pathways that will lead to increased susceptibility to death. So imagine a lung cancer patient where he has low MSH2, so a mismatch repair that is not very good, a methylation of BRCA1, so you also have an homologous recombination pathway that is not effective, and on top of that, you give cisplatinum plus a PARP inhibitor. I'm sure it's going to be strike. It's going to be a home run too. So we are looking for new trials with PARP inhibitors in lung.
Interesting. Vince?
We have some preliminary data from one of the labs we work with basically supporting that in the EGFR mutant patients, some of the most critical genes that could be synthetically lethal are DNA repair genes.
Absolutely.
Can you kind of talk a little bit more about your concept, Jean-Charles, of synthetic lethality and other examples and concepts about that?
Sure. I mean, going back to the ovarian data that was presented with the PARP inhibitor by AstraZeneca, showing monotherapy activity, impressive monotherapy activity in cisplatin-resistant ovarian cancers, the whole idea was when you block PARP, you prevent from single-strand break repair and then get double-strand break repair. This usually doesn't kill the cell, but it will kill the cell if at the same time in that cell you have a deficient homologous recombination that is linked to the fact that that ovarian cancer is BRCA1 mutated.
So, Tony, let's talk about circulating DNA.
There are circulating DNA in every body, including lung cancer patient, and then the lung cancer with the mutation could shed the DNA into the blood. So we had a recent publication in Clinical Cancer Research using a technique called digital PCR, which basically is a cassette with about 9,600 wells. We use hydraulic pressure to distribute the DNA into each well. And then we do the PCR sequencing using the exon 19 or 21 primer. And then whatever DNA is in the well will manifest itself. So with this technique, we only have a small study that was reported about 40-some sample. We managed to get about 70-80% sensitivity. So based on this, we are actually doing a larger prospective study. And hopefully, this will be one alternative method to detect the plasma DNA of the EGFR mutation.
So, Tom, what do you think about circulating DNA and what about circulating tumor cells that you all reported in the New England Journal?
So I think circulating DNA is very promising, and there's a number of groups in China, actually, that have reported on it in lung cancer in general. I think it's a very exciting technology. One of the advantages you get with circulating tumor cells is the ability to characterize the cells nicely in terms of ultimately being able to create cell lines. From a research tool standpoint, it's very exciting. We think that people who have metastatic disease will almost universally have circulating tumor cells in a number of common solid tumors. In fact, people probably even with early stage disease have circulating tumor cells. The newer technologies are able to assay the frequency of circulating tumor cells, which seems to correlate with benefit from therapy, and also to profile the circulating tumor cells. Now, there are a couple of hurdles. The first is that this technology is still very much emerging, and it's not something that's easily transportable to a number of different centers and sites. And so that's a big challenge as we move forward. The second is you don't know when you get circulating tumor cells, what are they reflective of? Are they reflective of cells that have already established metastasis? Are they reflective of cells that have metastatic potential? Because you might find pathways turned on and off in circulating tumor cells, what does that mean about areas that are resistant? If you look at EGFR resistance as a marker, Jeff Engelman's work showed that you can have a lung met. In fact, this is work he did with Dr. Mitsudomi. You can have a lung metastasis that has a MET amplification and a bone metastasis that has T790M. Well, what are the circulating tumor cells going to show? Are they going to show the lung metastasis, the bone metastasis, or neither? So it's not perfect yet, but as a window to looking at easily accessible tumor, I think that it does have a lot of promise.
Jean-Charles?
Yeah, I fully agree that the fact that blood-based markers are extremely important for serial analysis of the behavior of the tumor, because the molecular portrait may change with time. It's going to be extremely difficult to stick needles every other 3 months. So blood-based biomarker may be a very appealing alternative.
I would like to echo to that. Actually, in our center, we already developed EBV DNA for NPC, and that actually has been established that the patient with active disease, once after treatment, they actually dropped dramatically down to zero EBV DNA. So this type of potentially circulating DNA is very helpful.
One final question I'd like to bring up, Vince, which is the whole approach to clinical research and tissue-based research in lung cancer. Jean-Charles and I were talking about the battle work that Ed Kim and Roy Herbst have done at MD Anderson, where they're doing extra biopsies on patients. You mentioned that. Do we need to move towards a situation where we're more aggressive about getting tissue? And how do patients respond to that idea?
Well, I think in the clinical platform, I think we need to test patients at the time of surgery for certain markers. Some of them have great fidelity over the lifetime of that individual. Generally, those are mutations. Other things are more variable over the natural history of the illness in the individual, like IHC and FISH for different markers. That will make the job a little easier when that patient relapses, as unfortunately most of our patients do, because you'll have some information already at hand, particularly if they don't have a readily accessible lesion to rebiopsy. I think in the clinical research platform, there are a lot of different ways to look at trials or at trial design. I think clearly the general message should be go a little slower in doing the trial, but get the information to answer the question. So just putting on patients with voluntary biopsies or voluntary tissue from the site in a phase two trial is not going to answer your question given the heterogeneity of lung cancer. If you chose conversely to study an enriched group with a particular profile, you're going to want to have that information at hand as well.
Joan, what's being done in the ECOG adjuvant study in terms of tissue translational work?
Well, we sure are collecting the tissue, that's for sure, and we're also collecting blood. And right now we're banking it because the study itself probably won't be done for another 5 years, and who knows what the state of the art will be at that point in time.
It's really amazing, Tom, getting back to the Oncotype, how they were able to utilize trials that have been done 20 years ago to really improve therapy today. Tom, what would you like to see done in terms of this whole arena, blank check? What are the kinds of things you'd like to see done in terms of this whole area of clinical research?
Well, I think you've heard from a number of people here that the commitment to obtaining tissue and blood from patients who are entered into clinical trials will become something which we will make much more common as we go forward. I think that one of the things that Vince's group and the battle Ed Kim and Roy Herbst have shown is that patients are very willing to participate in studies which require repeat biopsy, that's something that inherently makes sense to patients. The idea that we're going to biopsy your tumor and we're going to base therapy based on what we found is something that patients find very appealing. And I think that the kind of studies that Jean-Charles was talking about, the adjuvant trial, which is biologically based, that kind of approach is something that we should be supportive of as we go forward. There are additional costs. This is something that has to be factored into how we approach this. But one could argue that personalized medicine of getting the right drug to the right patient based on an understanding of the biology of the disease ultimately will be cost effective as we go forward.
Tony, any thoughts?
I echo to what Tom said, but I look at it in a bit of philosophical fashion. EGFR mutation have made a big difference to the cancer management. So now we're talking about presence or absence of EGFR, presence or absence of a biomarker. But other than looking at the absence of a biomarker, we should look into as a presence of a biomarker that we have not identified it yet. So we have the EGFR, and now that was about 10% of the whole population, 4% of their ML, but maybe there's another 5% of something else, 10% of something else. So eventually, if we identify enough marker, we were able to provide a specific therapy to each individual patient according to the marker that they possess. That's the direction we take, and again, tissue, blood.
Joan?
Yeah, no, I would certainly agree with both of them. I do think it's real easy to say, let's get the tissue, let's get repeat biopsies, but it is expensive. And I think the battle trial really shows, I mean, it's a very expensive trial. So if I had a lot of money, it would be to establish the fact that that can be done more universally and not just in a couple of institutions.
And Vince, we've seen that, particularly in breast cancer, community-based settings. U.S. Oncology has been able to get tissue from their patients and ship it off to MD Anderson. I mean, this can be done, should it be done in lung cancer?
Yeah, I think that certainly it's the right time for that type of approach. I think that industry can help by coming up with more logical study designs that their investigators often contribute to. And I think there needs to be, I hate to say it, I think there needs to be a change in the way clinical trials are done, that some of these trials are caught up in minutiae that just slow the field down and slow the progress down with measuring QTC interval every 14 seconds instead of trying to understand why and when a drug works and why and when it doesn't work.
Jean-Charles?
Yeah, I can't agree more, but I think it's going to take a change in practice to move to personalized medicine, and that means better teaching the pathologists and better recognizing the value of their work, because they do pattern recognition with their eyes, but molecular medicine will come from them too, and we will need to compensate them more to do this additional work. And we will need to have a different setting in our hospitals, because one of the problems you have when you are in consultation with a patient and you are under pressure to decide for a second line is that getting you a new bronchoscopy or a new interventional radiology biopsy is a nightmare. It's going to take you 10 minutes, even if you are a full professor, to negotiate that within a reasonable frame time. So we will need to put a size of interventional radiology and bronchoscopy a little different so we can get those things done quickly.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special highlights program of a satellite symposium at the 13th World Conference on Lung Cancer of the International Association of the Study of Lung Cancer.